And I have to confess, as a person of European descent, you know, I'm part of that and I'm taking the benefit of it. But it's time for a change. And the kind of change that's required is not breaking down traditional values in regional countries and clearing the way, or so that multinational corporations from the United States and Great Britain and Europe more generally can come in and do business with billionaires in places like India, so that at the top end of the human scrap heap, they're lapping it all up and doing well and saying GDP is growing, while people at the bottom are suffering more than ever with rising prices and lower wages. So I don't think this is the way to go. I see it happening around the world. I see it happening here in Indonesia. I see a calculated effort to break down traditional values and clear the way with false promises for Western corporations to come in and cover the field and establish monopolies and oligopolies that basically put small businesses out of business.
According to Indian economists, foreign firms won't be able to compete with the local firms, thus incurring higher costs compared to national companies. Underwater structure projects involving large-scale medical equipment or artificial intelligence are the areas where the foreign companies have an edge over the local businesses. Cost being the major factor, the competition in majority of sectors is with ASEAN countries or China. As per the agreement, procurement has been open to UAE companies in 34 central government ministries, including Ministry of Economic Affairs, New and Renewable Energy, Power, etc.
Allowing access to the UAE to procure government tenders has resulted in the opening of the floodgates to similar demands from other countries India is negotiating with. These include the European Union, the UK and Australia. The agreement with the UAE is being used as a benchmark by other negotiating countries. Additionally, countries with which India already has FTAs may push for including access to $500 billion Indian government procurement market in the agreements.
In a surprising move, India and the European Union resumed negotiations in June 2022 for a free trade agreement after almost a decade. EU's demands include inclusion of concessions extended to other FTA partners, namely UAE, along with duty cuts on automobiles, dairy products. India also has ongoing talks with the UK, Australia and Canada. All these countries are eyeing the Indian central government procurement market. According to the Indian government officials, the UK and EU will not negotiate if the public procurement market is kept out of the trade talks. Australia has also been asking for similar access as given to the UAE.
Well, I think it's very difficult to ever conceive of a situation that has large corporations facing a threat from smaller, more efficient companies. I don't think the business sector, the private sector, works that way. The way corporatism works, basically, is huge corporations come into a country, whether it's by making promises or through corrupt payments or whatever it takes, and initially perform in order to be able to say, look, we're delivering a better product at the lower price, which helps everybody, including consumers. But once they've established themselves, they're like a caterpillar or a moth. They metamorphosize into something horrible that destroys all other possibilities, including local smaller businesses. It's very difficult for small businesses to survive, let alone threaten the supremacy of big corporations in a place where corporations have been allowed to come in and basically dominate the roost. So I don't see there being a scenario once these multinational corporations start coming in and doing trade with India, which understandably is primarily concerned about its own economic interests, that sees ordinary small businesses and medium-sized businesses and domestic businesses and individuals protected from what's going to play out. This is all part of the grander scheme for U.S. hegemony, or if you like, Atlantic world hegemony, where everybody's dancing to a set of rules that's drafted in America.
According to the experts, if a national treatment clause is included in the FDA's, it would mean similar treatment to foreign small companies. Given that foreign micro, small, and medium enterprises are very strong, it would create stiff competition for their domestic counterparts. The economists regard this as the real cause of concern, as providing a particular area means agreement to give access to other areas. Public procurement, being a huge market, is always preferred. In both scenarios, Indian businesses face danger of foreign entities entering the domestic market and increasing competition.
So we have discussed public procurement as part of free trade agreements of India with different countries. Now, let's switch to social media and see what people around the world had to say on this issue.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Mark Warner tweeted, "Public procurement of contracts worth over 200 crore rupees were opened up in the FTA signed with the UAE last year, and now every country India is negotiating with, including the EU, UK and Australia, is gunning for access to the public procurement market." John G. Murphy, an economic expert, wrote, "UK expects to strike FTA with India and accede to TPP in 2023, reports Bloomberg. The administration's view that FTAs are passé is a lonely one." Shantanu Singh, an economist, tweeted, "People aware of the development said that Indian companies, especially those in the IT sector, have also sought access to the public procurement market in the EU and the UK." Mint, a news portal, wrote, "The inclusion of public procurement in the UAE agreement marked a first for India, which has been notoriously shy of opening up this lucrative market to foreign companies."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Contrary to the claims of the Modi-led BJP government, the intensity of attacks on the civilian population in Jammu and Kashmir has increased in recent years. These attacks have mainly been aimed on the minority Kashmiri Pandit community and the non-resident Hindus living in Kashmir. Experts say that the armed group's strategy to attack the non-locals and minorities is a way to signal opposition to the means employed by the Bharatiya Janata Party to change the demography of the Muslim-majority region.
With the start of the new year, the state of Jammu and Kashmir witnessed the killing of four civilians in the Rajouri district by unidentified gunmen. Two more people, including a child, died the following day when a blast rocked the area. Conflicting with the return of normalcy as claimed by the BJP government, at least 18 non-local Hindus and Kashmiri Pandits have been killed since the abrogation of Article 370. According to the data provided by the government of India, the violence has seen no downward trend since the revocation of the statehood in the year 2019. The Modi-led BJP government had cited the special status of Jammu and Kashmir as the primary reason for violence. 229 armed attacks were recorded in the year 2021, leading to 40 civilian killings. The number went to 30 civilian killings in the year 2022. In the years 2017 and 2016, 279 and 322 attacks were reported, thus showing no significant improvement in the situation, as wrongly portrayed by New Delhi. The central BJP government has been asserting that the abrogation of Article 370 brought normalcy to the violence-ridden region. However, the opposite appears to be true. In the year 2013, prior to Modi's coming to power, only 170 cases of violence were reported from the Himalayan region.
Contrary to the popular belief that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc to the economy of Jammu and Kashmir, statistics show a different picture. After the abrogation of Article 370, the investments in the region dropped from $72.3 million in 2018-2019 to $36.3 million in the year 2019-2020. According to the Government of India's recent figures, the investment has decreased by more than 50% since the revocation of the special status of the Himalayan region.
The claim that the abrogation of the semi-autonomous status of the state will lead to economic development in the region has failed on the ground. Last year in December, India's Minister of State for Home Affairs, Nityanand Rai, gave figures about the economic status of Jammu and Kashmir. According to the statistics, the investments in the region have fallen by 55% in the past 4 years. Previously blaming the local governments for the economic backwardness in the region, the BJP government in New Delhi has not been able to put the union territory directly ruled by the center on the road to economic development as had been promised earlier. According to the data published by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs, the total investment in the year 2017 to 2018 was $102.8 million, considerably decreasing to $50.5 million in the year 2019 to 2022. And in 2021 to 2022, the investments were recorded to be $46 million, thus laying bare the false claims of economic growth in the region. Earlier, Modi-led BJP government would cite restrictions on the procurement of land as the main reason for economic backwardness of the Himalayan region. However, after the abrogation of Article 370, the government still has not been able to bring private sector investment to the state, thus ruining the economy further.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, contrary to the rosy picture painted by the BJP government, the civilian killings of the non-resident Hindus and Kashmir Pandits have increased. So the question is, do you think the armed groups have changed their tactics after the abrogation of Article 370?
First of all, we all should condemn the killing of civilian for whatever pretext somebody is doing this. Nobody can justify killings of civilians by any means, whether they are pandits or non-Kashmiri residents or whoever. Having said this, that I think that the civilian pandits, Kashmiri pandits, or the non-resident Kashmiris are being made cannon fodder by the Indian government. Indian government has a plan to change the demography of occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. For that, they are bringing in non-Kashmiris in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And they have changed not just the state of the disputed state, but also they have changed the laws about the domiciles and the residents. So that has enabled them to bring non-resident Kashmiris. And by doing this, actually the BJP government is fueling tension between different religions. So because the demographic changes being made in Kashmir are based on the religion, because predominantly Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, and which should have been something India could have taken pride in that, that it has a state which is majority Muslim state, and that suited the Indian claim of secularism. But since the BJP is in power, which is a Hindu fascist and nationalist government, they are trying to change the demography on the basis of Hindu Muslims. So they are bringing in more Hindus, and which are actually creating troubles for the Hindu pandits, which are Kashmiris and very much state subject. They lived there for centuries, and they used to have very cordial relations with the Muslim majority of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But now they are also in trouble because of these political policies of BJP, which I think which will not only backfire within Kashmir, but elsewhere in India as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, citing the special status as a roadblock to the economic development of the region, statistics show that investments in the region have fallen by 55%. Now, conflicting with the claims, has the withdrawal of the special status been responsible for the decrease in economic investments?
Hey, you know, this is very interesting that the BJP says that after abrogation of special status to Kashmir, they will bring in investment. While destroying the economy of Kashmiri traders and Kashmiri businessmen for almost now 10 years, consistently destroying the local economy, how can you actually improve the economic condition of the state, the people of the state? This is, I think, not understandable to common sense that local economy, you know, the blockade of the Kashmiri traders, it remained for months. And the Kashmir is practically in siege for almost 2 years now, and 2.5 years now. And you claim that you will bring investment, and that is not possible. And as you mentioned, the statistics have shown that it is not possible. Actually, it is hypocrisy at its best. Whatever the BJP government is trying to do in Kashmir is actually to strengthen its occupation. And for that, their sole objective is to weaken the will of the local people by whatever means. And they are trying to bring in, as I earlier mentioned, non-resident people. And now they are trying to bring in the business community of India into Kashmir while depriving the local businessmen of their own businesses. This is ridiculous. You cannot actually prosper as a state or a territory while the local people are deprived of their basic livelihoods and you are bringing in other investors. That's not possible. And this is the, this is the basic objective the Modi had presented Kashmir as a business hub for non-resident business community to come in and to benefit from the tourism and other businesses available in Kashmir. And the sole objective is actually to destroy the local businesses. Now, I think that will not work. Whatever India try, that will not work for India and not for the people of the Kashmir.
Mr. Khan, we've seen that violence in the region has not improved in the past few years as claimed by the BJP government. So has the centre's iron fist policy turned counterproductive in the Himalayan region?
History is a teacher, but we tend not to listen from it, not to learn from it. Everybody knows that you cannot crush the will of the people by iron fist or whatever strict policies you adopt. This is not for the first time India is adopting very strict policies. India killed more than 100,000 people in Kashmir, but the Kashmiri people never, ever, bore down in front of Indian pressure. They still demand their right of self-determination, and this is the will of the people. You know, whatever India uses sometimes stick, sometimes carrot, policy for the people of Kashmir. Sometimes they try to appease them, sometimes they try to coerce them. But both have failed in the past and both will fail in the past, in future as well, because the people of Jammu and Kashmir want to have their right of self-determination. And India should actually give them their the opportunity to exercise their right, which India itself had committed under the UN Security Council resolutions. And it was basically India which took Kashmir issue into United Nations, not Pakistan. India was losing the war at that time because the Kashmiri people had taken up arms and this Azad Kashmir and Gilgit Baltistan, that was liberated by the people. And India was fearful that Srinagar was about to fall, and when India took that to UN Security Council, now India is obliged to fulfill its own commitments at international forums, which India is denying and which will cost India miserably in the future.
Now, Mr. Khan, last but not least, the incidence of violence in Kashmir has seen a downward trend before Modi's coming to power. So the question is, has the anti-Muslim policy of the BJP further alienated the people of the region and pushed them to the wall?
Actually, we see the violence of the Kashmiri militant groups against the Indian state, that is irrespective of who is in power in the center, whether it is BJP, whether it is Congress, whether it is a united front of different political parties. The Kashmiri people are actually resistant against the occupation of India, and they want to exercise their right of self-determination, which was deprived by India. So the basic thing is that the militant groups, they will carry their work, whether it is BJP, whether it is some other government. But having said that, the strict policies which in BJP has applied on Kashmir, it actually helped the militant groups to recruit more and more Kashmiri youth. There was a time that then there was a mix of non-Kashmiri and Kashmiri militants. Now we are seeing that majority of the militants operating in Kashmir are purely the Kashmiri youth. So that is a phenomena which changed during the BJP's government, that more youth is being radicalized in Kashmir and they are joining different militant groups. And this is for the first time in the history of Kashmir that during BJP's government, we have seen the presence of Daesh in Kashmir and we have seen presence of Al-Qaeda in Kashmir. It never happened. So that is the level of, suppression and depression among the Kashmiri youth, which can actually become catastrophic for India and for the region as well. So that is something which is new in Kashmir, and that is the result of the BJP's policies.
There you have it, Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sharp Media Network tweeted, "No developments in Indian illegally occupied Jammu and Kashmir during last 4 years. The last 4 years have ruined the entire economy of Jammu and Kashmir, which has in reality collapsed. Unemployment is at its peak and youth is in utter frustration." Frontier Indica wrote, "It's no secret that under Modi, the security situation in Punjab has gotten much worse, and the benefits of revocation of Article 370 vis-a-vis the safety of common people in J&K, especially KPs, have also been short-lived." The Wire, a prominent news portal, tweeted, "The people of Kashmir say silence, fear, rising prices, and unemployment have taken over the region after August 5, 2019. Jammu-based reserve category employee working in Kashmir tweeted, "Situation in Kashmir is not yet conducive, but still being forced to resume duties. I don't know why. We are not with any Z security and weapon to defend ourselves, still forced by stopping salaries. Our life is also valuable to our old parents, if yours matters to your parents."
And that was our episode about the FTA's public procurement and the apprehensions of Indian business houses, and also the worrying economic and security situation in Jammu and Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Russia has given a positive but cautious response to a Chinese peace plan to end the war in Ukraine and emphasized it was paying a great deal of attention to the details of the plan. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said any initiatives that might bring peace closer were worthy of attention, and Beijing's voice should certainly be heard. But he also said the nuances of the proposal were very important. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia Today has covered this story and tells us more. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov says any call for peace deserves attention, but Russia doubts that de-escalation of the conflict is possible for now. Russia is closely studying a China-proposed peace plan for Ukraine, but currently sees no opportunity for a political resolution of the conflict. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov outlined on Monday, 27th of February. Any attempt to work out plans which would encourage switching the conflict onto a peaceful track deserves attention, including the proposal from our Chinese friends, spokesman Dmitry Peskov said. As for the details, they should be the subject of careful analysis, taking into account the interests of the parties, Dmitry Peskov noted, describing it as a very long and intense process. The Kremlin spokesman, however, cautioned that Moscow sees no preconditions for a resolution of this whole situation in a peaceful direction, adding that the Russian military operation in Ukraine continues as we move towards achieving the set goals. The 12-point plan was released by the Chinese Foreign Ministry last Friday, 24th of February, and involves a range of measures from a ceasefire and peace talks to abandoning Cold War mentality and sanctions, while promoting global stability and international supply chains. Among other things, Beijing urged the parties involved to respect the sovereignty of all countries. The Russian Foreign Ministry responded to the roadmap for peace last week, with spokeswoman Maria Zakharova expressing appreciation for Beijing's contribution to the settlement of the conflict in Ukraine by peaceful means. Ukraine's backers, however, have brushed off the Chinese peace proposal, with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg declaring that Beijing doesn't have much credibility after refusing to side with the United States on the issue. Russia sent troops into Ukraine on 24th of February 2022, citing Kiev's failure to implement the Minsk agreements, which were designed to give Donetsk and Luhansk special status within the Ukrainian state. The protocols, brokered by Germany and France, were first signed in 2014. Former Ukrainian President Pyotr Poroshenko has since admitted that Kiev's main goal was to use the agreement to buy time and create powerful armed forces. This idea was also confirmed by the then Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, and the then President of France, François Hollande. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. The Kremlin on Monday, 27th of February, said that it is paying close attention to China's 12-point peace plan for the Russia-Ukraine war, which Beijing released last Friday. Any attempt to develop a plan that will help to transfer the conflict to a peaceful course deserves attention. We treat the plan of our Chinese friends with great attention, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told a press briefing in the Russian capital Moscow. In response to a question on the details of the Chinese peace plan, Peskov said it should be thoroughly analysed, taking into account the interests of the various parties, and further noting, this is a very intense process. On Friday, 24th of February, the Chinese Foreign Ministry released a statement listing the Beijing's position on a political settlement to the war in Ukraine, where 12 points were listed, including respecting the sovereignty of all countries involved, ceasing hostilities, resuming peace talks, and resolving the humanitarian crisis in the region. The plan also calls for keeping nuclear power plants safe, facilitating grain exports, and stopping unilateral sanctions, noting that dialogue and negotiation are the only viable solution to the crisis in Ukraine. Dmitry Peskov also touched on tensions in Transnistria and said Moscow is closely monitoring the situation in the breakaway region amid claims last week by the Russian Defense Ministry that Ukraine plans an armed provocation in the region. Naturally, the situation in Transnistria is the object of our closest attention and a reason for our concern, Dmitry Peskov said. Peskov reiterated that the situation in Transnistria is very tense, claiming that it is provoked from the outside. We know that our opponents, both in the Ukrainian regime and in European countries, are capable of various kinds of provocations. We know this well, and we are aware of this report, Dmitry Peskov said. On Thursday, the Russian Defense Ministry claimed that Ukraine is preparing an armed provocation against Transnistria, an unrecognized breakaway region internationally recognized as part of Moldova, but currently controlled by pro-Russian separatists. The statement claimed that an offensive against Russian troops in the breakaway region is planned to be staged, with Ukrainian forces allegedly being dressed in the Russian Armed Forces uniform. In response, the Moldovan government has said in a statement that the authorities do not confirm the claims from the Russian Defense Ministry. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov also said the West is experiencing a shortage of things to sanction, as the European Union announced it adopted a 10th sanctions package late on Friday with new trade bans and export controls on products and technologies that can be used for civilian and military purposes. It is clear that the West have a certain shortage of objects for sanctioning, which explains the illogical inclusion of certain individuals and legal entities in the list of sanctions, Dmitry Peskov said. Dmitry Peskov further noted that these sanctions will obviously continue, claiming that the new legal entities and individuals will be added to the list in an absurd way. All of this, of course, is absurd, and it is obvious that it is not clear who is already being put on sanctions, people who are completely unrelated to some kind of sanctions topic, just to form some new lists, Dmitry Peskov said. Peskov also said he's certain that the implementation of the sanctions will not cause any discomfort for the people involved. The website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered this story and tells us more. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he plans to meet Chinese President Xi Jinping, but did not say when such a meeting might take place. "I plan to meet President Xi Jinping and believe this will be beneficial for our countries and for security of the world," Volodymyr Zelensky said at a news conference in Kiev on the first anniversary of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky had earlier reiterated that he would not hold peace talks with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin.
We'll be right back. Hidden Files. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Children's carefree laughter is one of the most heartwarming sounds in the world. Watching them run around, fall, and get back on their feet again gives us hope for life. Now, what would it be like if, instead of nice and strong skin, the children's body was covered with a layer as delicate as the wings of a butterfly? What if every little bump would mean a burning blister? How then would a child run and play and fill the world with joy? Today's program is on the plight of Iran's butterfly children, whose access to medicine is entangled with political sanctions placed on the country. But who are the butterfly children, and what exactly is their condition?
Epidermolysis bullosa is a genetic condition which affects the skin. It is caused by faults in the proteins that act as the glue which holds our layers of skin together. In EB, the slightest knock or bump causes the skin layers to separate, making blisters and wounds. Kids born with it are often called butterfly children because their skin is as fragile as the wings of a butterfly. Skin is our protection from the outside world. Skin that is working properly allows us to play, run, hug, sleep without a thought. It's not the same for people who live with EB. Walking becomes increasingly hard over time as the feet get more and more damaged. The simple joy of holding a crayon becomes difficult as the fingers fuse together. And eating is frightening as the lining of the throat blisters, sometimes causing kids to choke. In really bad cases, almost no part of the body remains untouched by EB. And people with it live with the constant threat of skin cancer. There is no cure for EB, and caring for children means agonizing 3-hour bandage changes every second day. It is a heartbreaking routine, usually done by mom or dad, and is so traumatizing it can have a devastating effect on the bond between parent and child. In fact, because EB care demands so much time, it can have a huge effect on all the family.
Living with this condition is painful enough when one has access to all the latest forms of treatment available, but there are parents and doctors around the world who are having to fight with forces beyond their biggest resources, like those who live in countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and many others. What forces are we exactly talking about? Well, we're talking about U.S.-imposed sanctions that make it nearly impossible for these patients to receive the much-needed medical supplies. And this is not only the case for EB patients in Iran. You see, one of the many requirements in living with this disease is a special type of bandage. This bandage must be able to help protect the patient's very fragile skin against any pressure that can cause it to blister. At the same time, this bandage must be made of special material so as not to stick to the patient's skin. Otherwise, in order to be changed, it has to be peeled off the EB patient, which can be extremely painful and cause terrible blisters by itself. And this special bandage is made by a Swedish company, a company that refuses to sell its products to Iranian EB patients as it fears being punished due to U.S. enforced sanctions on Iran. There were some heart-rending stories that I heard while visiting the EB home, and the NGO has sent official letters to the company requesting that the required medical supplies be sold to Iranian patients, as you see here. Yet, the company's response is that it cannot be done, unfortunately, due to the U.S. economic sanctions in force. Now, the question is, what remains is the legality of these sanctions internationally, and what can be done to resolve the issues faced by these patients? So, to discuss this situation further, we will be joined shortly by United Nations Special Rapporteur, Dr. Elena Duhon.
Dr. Elena Duhon is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. She is a professor of international law. Her teaching and research concentrate on sanctions and human rights law, international law, and international environmental law. She is the author of more than 150 books and articles on international law. She has over 40 publications which focus on human rights, targeted and comprehensive sanctions, unilateral coercive measures, and freedom of opinion.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Duhan. What's your assessment of the effect of U.S. unilateral sanctions on the people of these nations?
Well, unfortunately, when it comes to the use of unilateral sanctions, people are affected. Usually, the whole population of the country is affected quite broadly, especially in the health area. So, situation in Iran is not so bad as it some other countries being under unilateral sanctions, in a view of the fact that Iran is producing more than 90% of its medicine domestically. We need to take into account, however, that even when the country is producing the medicine domestically, people which are in need of this medicine may still be affected. Take into account that countries need to import raw materials for the medicine. And unfortunately, with the use of unilateral sanctions, especially the comprehensive unilateral sanctions towards Iran, many producers of raw materials are very much reluctant to sell raw materials to Iran. There are problems with delivery and payment. There is a need to use alternative means for payments and delivery. And therefore, it's very complicated to guarantee necessary quality of raw materials.
Well, you talked about the restrictions and the difficulties. What can be done about this situation?
I received information about this situation a few months ago, and I have drafted a communication to the company and to Sweden asking for the assistance on that situation. And unfortunately, the responses which I received unofficially were demonstrating the concerns of the company to be subjected to the sanctions of the United States from one side because of getting money from Iran. Secondly, there were concerns about the ways to get payment from Iran and the ways to deliver these bandages from Sweden to Iran. Previous time, that was UNICEF, which directly engaged into negotiations with Sweden, which resulted in the possibility to deliver the year storage of bandages. Unfortunately, the storage will be over around September this year. And now UNICEF is cooperating again with Sweden and the company trying to deliver these bandages to the EB patients. Unfortunately, as I have said, that's an ad hoc solution. After coming back from Iran, I also had a meeting with the ambassador of Sweden, and we discussed this situation, and I pointed out that the ad hoc solution is not a solution for the problem. People shall not leave not knowing whether they will be able to get the bandages tomorrow or in a year or not, and what caused them suffering and naturally deteriorate their quality of life. So I asked them to get engaged with the company and to guarantee the unimpeded procurement of this medicine.
What is it going to take to resolve this once and for all?
So the very first step, what the United Nations did, it established this mandate. So basically that was a response to the use of unilateral sanctions and plus to the humanitarian impact unilateral sanctions do. So as I have mentioned, I tried to raise awareness to show specific evidences of humanitarian impact, because what I often face in my work is when I start to talk to the embassies of the countries in which the companies producing the unique equipment are registered, they say, oh, we didn't know, we didn't realize that people are suffering that much and that people are dying. So that was the very first step of the activity of the United Nations. Again, when we are speaking about the short-term solutions, the UN agencies in the countries, and in particular, I speak about a number of specialized agencies in Iran, are very actively engaging now to guarantee the delivery of the basic medical goods necessary for the survival of the people. For example, UNICEF in Iran is very actively engaging to procure the bandages to the EB patients and to procure some other necessary medical equipment for people suffering from severe diseases. However, we need to realize that that's ad hoc solutions, trying to handle the situation for a very short period for a very limited group of people. Around a month ago, me together with some other special rapporteurs have issued a press release calling for a total lifting of unilateral sanctions imposed over critical infrastructure, medical goods, without any need to get extra licenses. Because today, unfortunately, something what has been announced to be called humanitarian exceptions is not functioning at all. It's necessary to get a license. It's necessary to find a way how to transfer money, how to guarantee the delivery. When we speak about EB patients in Iran, the recent attempt of UNICEF to deliver a little bit more than a year storage of bandages for EB patient took a year and a half. And today they are trying to engage into delivery of the second delivery. At the same time, I believe that the United Nations shall guarantee that this means all sorts of critical goods are exempted from the use of unilateral sanctions, first of all. In the long-term perspective, I try now to engage with many UN institutions as well as with states and humanitarian actors and scholars to bring attention to the issue of legality. If states will stop to use illegal means, that will mean that we won't need to have the notion what is called humanitarian exception, because sanctions will not be imposed and the states will be able to guarantee the delivery of life-saving medicine.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Dr. Elena Duhani. Now, Iran's EB patients have only a few months' worth of special bandages left. They don't know if and when they can receive the next shipment. Many are too young to even understand what sanctions are, and others can't see why their treatment should have anything to do with politics and sanctions against Iran, which are deemed illegal by international standards. Plus, it's not only EB patients who are suffering as a result of these sanctions. All patients whose required medicine and treatment are not entirely made in Iran are affected by these multifaceted sanctions. Now, this leaves Iran's doctors no choice but to either find a way to get around the sanctions or to tell their patients, sorry, I don't think that you will make it. Isn't it ironic, though, that these sanctions are placed on Iran by the U.S., which claims to be the flag bearer of human rights, when in reality Washington has one of the worst records of waging wars against various nations, using their government's violation of these same rights as an excuse. And now the war is on. The U.S. government against special needs patients in sanctioned countries. Will the special needs patients win this battle and be able to heal their wounds, or will the U.S. manage to cause them to die in agony? Either way, these innocent patients will be the only victors in this cowardly war. Until next week, when we come to you to shed light on a whole other set of Hidden Files. Goodbye for me, Marzieh Hashemi, and from the whole crew right here in the studio.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters,
6040 kHz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Satorbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
Tens of thousands of UK teachers are to stage fresh strikes in dispute over pay. Tens of thousands of teachers will strike this week, resulting in the closure of some schools as members of the National Education Union, NEU, take part in 3 days of industrial action. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Press TV, tens of thousands of teachers across England and Wales are slated to take part in 3 days of industrial action this week in the long-running dispute over pay, resulting in the closure of schools. Teachers in Northern England will walk out, with the majority of schools expected to either restrict access to some pupils or fully close, the National Education Union, the country's largest teachers' union, said in a statement. They will be followed by their colleagues in Midlands and Eastern regions. The industrial action will continue in London and other parts of Southern England and Wales. NEU had earlier announced that its members were to walk out in February, adding that the industrial action was prompted by the government's refusal to increase pay amid double-digit inflation. The union has called for a fully funded above-inflation pay rise following a decade of eroded wages. Kevin Courtney, the NEU Joint General Secretary, predicted more than 200,000 teachers to take action and 50,000 more to join since the strike was first announced a month ago. I think a majority of schools will be affected by the dispute, some of them with full closures and many more with partial closures, he said ahead of the strikes in the north of England. Adding some secondary schools will be completely closed. Others will have particular year groups in and a similar pattern in a lot of primary schools. The country's largest education union has seen 50,000 new sign-ups since the strikes were announced 6 weeks ago, Courtney noted. British Education Secretary Gillian Keegan has called the strike action unforgivable, adding that children deserve to be in class, especially after the coronavirus pandemic. More than 23,000 schools and millions of students across the country were affected in last month's strike in England. Thousands of teachers took to the streets after a decade of meager payments in a state-funded school system. According to the Department of Education, 9.3% of state schools in England were entirely closed in the previous strike, and almost 45% were partially open with restricted attendance. Less than 1 in 5 elementary schools was kept open as teachers took to strike against the government's resistance to raise wages in line with the skyrocketing inflation. The wave of paralyzing strikes in England and Wales came after the workers' demands for a pay increase were rejected by the government, as the government has offered civil servants a 2-3% pay hike and says it cannot afford high increases that match the soaring inflation. During the past month, thousands of healthcare workers, teachers, nurses, airport baggage handlers, border staff, driving instructors, bus drivers, firefighters, and postal workers have walked off their jobs today.